Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Desiree Mays. She is an international storyteller and lecturer on opera. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, which is the book that comes out every year to accompany the season of the Santa Fe Opera. And she speaks nightly at the Santa Fe Opera during the opera season. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
It's nice to have you. Today we're talking about The Marriage of Figaro by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
This is a very popular piece. It's been popular here and popular, I think, ever since the first time it appeared in the late 1700s. Mozart was beginning to get into his stride at this point, and he was living in Vienna. He was happily married. He found a wonderful librettist called Lorenzo da Ponte, who is a highly colorful character, who was actually responsible for getting The Marriage of Figaro produced, I suppose, because the play had been banned by the Emperor Joseph II in Vienna had known about this play, and it was seen as an incendiary play. It's about how servants can outwit their masters. And when it appeared in France, it caused consternation, and the Austrian Emperor decided this was not going to be allowed to happen. So when Mozart proposed the idea of making an opera of The Marriage of Figaro to da Ponte, they said, well, we have a problem here, the play is banned, but da Ponte said, leave it with me, I'll go and talk to the emperor, which he did. He went to the emperor, and you could do that in those days. You get an audience, and this was a wonderful, enlightened man, and he loved music, and he knew about music. So he listened, and he said, well, what about Mozart? How good is Mozart? And da Ponte said, he's fine. And the emperor said, well, send him over, and I'll listen to some of the music, and we'll talk about it. And da Ponte assured him that he'd take out any political reference, anything that might offend the court or the emperor, and he got permission to do it. The emperor called in Mozart, who played some of the pieces, and they said, go for it. So it was an interesting way, the way this opera got off the ground, and it really cemented the relationship between da Ponte and Mozart. Da Ponte was really was the court poet, but he didn't have a lot of experience with writing opera libretti. He certainly, however, did a wonderful job with this. They worked together on three operas, The Marriage of Figaro, Così fan tutte, and Don Giovanni. These two were an incredible partnership on those three operas, and they call the three operas lessons of love. So in each of the three, there's a lesson to be learned. And in this one, I think it's about the power of forgiveness. Sometimes we need to forgive. No one's perfect, and forgiveness is necessary, even though, you know, the sin may happen again. People, again, are not perfect. So if you, fall down once, it may happen a few times, and forgiveness needs to be ongoing. So I think that's the message in this opera, and we'll get to that at the very end.
It's so interesting. This opera premiered in 1781. That was 8 years before the French Revolution.
Right.
And this whole theme of servants outwitting their aristocratic masters was something that had to be banned and repressed, but it just goes to show you can never finally repress that stuff.
Absolutely, and that is a theme throughout the opera, and today we wonder, you know, how they really got away with it, because the French Revolution was looming on the horizon. It was a touchy subject for anyone who took this seriously, but the nobility seemed to just ignore it. They thought this was great fun. They never took it really seriously, though there are a couple of arias in the opera that deal with it. The Count says at one point, you know, who are you, Figaro? You weren't born to make me suffer. I am your lord and master. And he totally assumes that he can have his wicked ways with Susanna, who is a servant, because she is in no position to say no. But she does.
Well, let's talk about that. So the plot is Figaro is a servant. He's the valet to the Count. He's about to marry the love of his life, Susanna, who is also a servant to the Countess.
Mm-hmm.
And the Count basically wants to have sex with Susanna right before she gets married, because that is the sexual right of aristocrats to do whatever they want with their servants.
Right. There was even a name for it, le droit du seigneur. It was the right of the lord of the manor to sleep with the servant on the eve of the wedding, if he chose. And this is what he chose. He actually, the count says that he has given up this practice. But when it comes down to it, he really hasn't. And he sort of blackmails Susanna. He says, well, I will give permission for your marriage, because they both had to get permission from him to be married. And he says, I'll give permission if you succumb to me, meet me in the garden later tonight. And the whole plot sort of revolves around that. And about Susanna, who is probably the central character in this opera, the way she stands firm against everything that happens. I mean, the piece is a comedy. There's nothing serious about this opera, except maybe its theme. And about the serious point is the way Mozart treats these characters. They're not stock cardboard comic characters. They have a humanity that's quite extraordinary, that is Mozart.
And I think the one serious and really poignant character is the Countess, who very much loves her husband, who's a philanderer. And there are some very sad, sweet, and serious arias where she's lamenting her position in life.
Yes, they're sad but not tragic. And
right.
And again, in this opera, Mozart, who's known for his irony, I mean, there's wonderfully ironic touches in most of his work. Not so much here. He really empathizes with the Countess. It's good to know a little background, I suppose, on the Countess. She is Rosina from The Barber of Seville. And this is because Caron de Beaumarchais, the French playwright, wrote a series of three plays, The Barber of Seville, Marriage of Figaro, and La Mère Coupable, is the third one that's not very often presented. But in The Barber of Seville, the Count Almaviva goes to Seville to seduce and carry off Rosina, who is the ward of one Dr. Bartolo, who thinks he is going to marry his ward. Doesn't happen, because the Count and Rosina fall passionately in love, and he carries her off into a happy married life, one would assume. But 3 years later, she is now installed as the Countess Almaviva. This is a powerful position. He was the Count Almaviva. The audience of the time would have known this, was the ambassador to England for Spain. He was a fairly influential noble. She's the Countess. She's feeling a little unhappy because she's been, she thinks, abandoned, put up on this ivory pedestal. The glow has run, fallen away from the relationship. The passion of first hot love has been worked out. And his eyes is roving, but she still loves him, and her two arias express that. We'll play one of those.
Should we do that now?
We could. We should. Let's start in then, if you'd like to do that, with the aria of the Countess. It is Dove Sono. The Countess doesn't actually appear in this opera until the second act. There's been a lot of chaos in the first act, but in the second act, we are in her bedroom, in her boudoir. In this period, there was a lot of opera scenes that were set as women are getting dressed for the day. It must have taken them all morning. And people would come in at different stages, apart from the hairdressers and everybody else, the costumers. They would seek audience with the Countess, and she would deal with things during this morning dress. It's amazing. But in this case, Mozart does something very different. She's alone. For the first time, the stage is completely bare. The Countess is in her dressing room, and she's singing Dove Sono, about how her heart is breaking, how she loves the Count, and how he is getting away from her. And the wonderful soprano in this excerpt is Kiri Tekanawa.
Let's hear it.
Thank you.
And today's opera is The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. Now, Desiree Mays, this opera takes place in Spain, but it's sung in Italian. What's up with that?
Yeah, and it's written by a man whose first language is German.
Right.
So this issue of language is very interesting in opera. If I should say right up front that I firmly believe that any opera should be presented, produced in the language in which it was written.
Are they ever not?
Oh, yes. It used to be, especially in this country, that everything would be translated into English, that Italian, German, whatever it was, French, would be translated into English so the audience could get it. That's a mistake on many levels. First of all, the poetry, the original poetry doesn't translate. It really doesn't. You lose so much. So as it's taken from one language to English, you lose it. The composer has composed music to the sound of those words. So where Puccini, for instance, composes music to amore, it doesn't compute to love,
right.
You know, a single symbol. So there's one very simple example why it should be kept in the original tongue.
Now, well, and here's another thing that we'll talk about next week when we talk about the opera Billy Budd. Even when they're singing in English, you can't understand what they're saying anyhow.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it changes your experience as an audience member because you're trying intellectually to follow the plot with the words, which you probably can't hear. And even with the singers with the most beautiful enunciation, you're at some notes on those higher levels are really hard to sing the actual syllable as we would understand it. So it is a little distorted. So it does take that angst out of the whole experience, especially now we have super titles. The words are there for us in English, so it's better sung in the original tongue. Again, my feeling is that once you get to an opera, the message, the story, the whole thing is going to come from the music. You don't have to follow line by line the libretto. The story will be obvious and you'll get it. Now, in the business of why is this opera written by a German in Italian about a French scenario...
Is that
at the time Mozart was composing music, the court believed that the correct language was Italian. So they liked their operas in Italian. But then Mozart was a real people person. So when he, for instance, he composed the Magic Flute for the people of Vienna in not the opera house but another theater, he composed it in German. In this case, the story is set, as you say, in Spain, but Italian was the court language. And this was the language that would be acceptable to the emperor and the court. So that's why this particular language is sung in Italian. Carmen is a very good example. We think of Carmen as the archetypal opera about Spain, but it's in French. And Bizet was a Frenchman. There's lots of wonderful French touches once you get into that opera, and yet we think of it as a Spanish opera. There's not a lot of operas actually in Spanish, come to think. Zarzuela, the lighter operas are, but not many Spanish operas per se. Singers are now required to sing in Russian or Czech. So this is a challenge we'll talk about down the road for the singers. But at this time, Italian was the accepted language. And some of the other operas we'll deal with, Billy Budd was composed in English, and so that will be in English. It depends on the time, and again, I think across the board, it's much better to perform an opera in its original tongue and not attempt to distort the poetry, supposing it is even halfway good poetry, because libretti are notorious for not being the greatest poetry. But Mozart said that a libretto was a message from the poet to the composer in order to inspire him to compose. It was not to be ever to be great opera. Maybe an exception is something like Pelléas and Mélisande that is taken from the Maeterlinck poem directly. And in that case, the poetry is quite lovely. But that's not always the case. In this case, there was the genius of Lorenzo da Ponte with Mozart that made, it was a marriage, I mean, incredible marriage of words and music. That's part of what this opera is, done in a comedic style that really works at every level.
We're talking to Desiree Mays, and she's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which accompanies the Santa Fe Opera during every season. Was this the eighth year that you've done this?
Oh, no, no, no. I've done now 10 books and 12 years at the Santa Fe Opera.
Oh, so this is the 10th anniversary of Opera
It is. It's my 10th book and about 12 years at the opera. I'm becoming a fixture.
Now, The Marriage of Figaro, one thing that's amazing is that the entire drama all takes place during the course of one day. And I have to say, I was watching a Metropolitan Opera recording of it on video, and it's just incredible how many different costumes these people wear in one day.
Yes, that was something else. You know, spectacle at this time was very important. People like to have things to look at, and fabulous costumes were a part of it. This year's production actually will continue that. The sets and the costumes will be in the tradition of the time. By Paul Brown, who does a wonderful job with the Santa Fe Opera's productions in that way. Yes, the subtitle is La Folle Journée, the crazy day. So it starts in her bedroom, and then it goes through the day, and then the whole thing ends up in the gardens at night, where all the various characters are meeting one another clandestinely, if that's a word, and no one quite knows who is meeting whom in which part of the garden. It's a real challenge for production to be able to do this, but it's fun. The whole thing works out in the end, of course.
Now, one of the themes that you talked about is forgiveness, but before we get to forgiveness, we have to talk about mistrust, which is one of the continual themes. Nobody trusts anybody because everybody is either trying to sleep with somebody else or there's a suspicion that they are, even if they aren't. Mm-hmm. There is a piece that we're going to hear in just a moment called Don't Trust Women, which is sung by Figaro.
Yes, this is an aria that comes at the end. Figaro is the central character in The Barber of Seville, which is, of course, by Rossini. In this opera, he's not really the driving force. Susanna is. Susanna is the one true virtuous, in quotes, character when she realizes that the Count has designs on her. She deals with it wonderfully. She tells the Countess, which, of course, defuses it. She also tells Figaro, her fiancé. But in the course of the opera, by the end, even Figaro is so confused that he suspects her. So he sings this wonderful aria that says, "Open your eyes, you rash and foolish men, and look at these women, see them as they are, these goddesses so called by the intoxicated senses, to whom feeble reason offers tribute. They are witches who cast spells for our torments, sirens who sing songs for our confusion, night owls who fascinate to pluck us, comets who dazzle to deprive us of light. They are thorned roses, alluring vixens, smiling." So he goes on. You know, he's really upset that at the end of all this shenanigans that has gone on for 2.5, 3 hours, it looks like Susanna is going to meet the Count in the garden. So let's play a little of this. And the wonderful Figaro on this recording is Ferruccio Furlanetto.
Aprite un poco gli occhi, uomini incauti e sciocchi, guardate queste femmine, guardate cosa son, guardate cosa son, guardate, guardate cosa son. Queste chiamate te agli ingannati sensi, a cui tributa incensi, la debole ragion, la debole ragion, la debole ragion. Sono streghe che incantano per farci penar, sirene che cantano per farci affogar, cive che allettano per trarci le piume, comete che brillano per toglierci il lume. Son rose spinose, son volpi pezzose, son orse benigne, colombe i maligni, maestri inganni, amiche d'affanni che fingono, mentono l'amore. Non sento, non sento pietà, non sento pietà, non, 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 il resto non dico, già ognuno lo sa. Aprite un poco gli occhi, uomini incauti, sciocchi, guardate queste femmine, guardate cosa son, cosa son, cosa son. Sono streghe che incantano, il resto non dico, sirene che cantano, il resto non dico, civette che allettano, il resto non dico, comete che brillano, il resto non dico, son rose spinose, son volpi pezzose, non orse benigne, colombe maligne, maestri in cammia, amiche da fanni che pingono, mento l'amore, non sento, non sento pietà, non sento pietà, non, 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 non. Il resto non dico, già ognuno lo sa. Il resto non dico, già ognuno lo sa. Già ognuno lo sa, già ognuno lo sa, già ognuno lo sa.
So that was the Figaro's aria near the end of The Marriage of Figaro. So maybe we should talk a little bit about how they're going to resolve this plot. It's a very complex story, but again, it's one of those situations when you're sitting in the theatre, it's quite clear what's going on. The next selection it would be fun to play is between the Countess and Susanna. These two women, now this is mistress and servant, and normally there was a great divide between these two classes of women. In this case, they're more like sisters, and this again is beginning to prefigure what's coming, you know, in terms of history. The Countess and Susanna cook up a plot. They're going to trap the Count. They're going to pretend that Susanna will go to the Count and tell him, yes, she agrees to meet him in the garden that night. But in fact, it'll be the Countess in Susanna's clothes. That's the plan.
So the Count thinks that he's going to have a tryst with
Susanna,
this lovely young servant, but instead his wife is going to show up in servant's clothing.
Yes, exactly. And he won't know the difference. That's where there's a little stretch of reality.
But yeah, well, opera and realism do not necessarily have anything to do with
that. No, they especially do not. So starting with singing to one another instead of speaking. So in this very beautiful duet, the Countess says, well, Susanna, sit down and I'll dictate a letter that will apparently be from you about the Count, asking the Count to meet you in the garden. So the two sit down and she dictates this letter. And it's a very touching letter because she suggests a rendezvous under the pines, and then she's actually describing the place, and Susanna's looking at her thinking, what went on under the pines? You know, she realized something had gone on. And it's a very private, personal note that the Countess has. She had been there with the Count, and they must have made love under the trees. And so she has some of these sort of built-in references. So she's dictating the letter to Susanna at this point in a really exquisite duet between the two women called Che Soave Zeffiretto. The Countess is carried to Canoa, and the Susanna is Dawn Upshaw.
Thank you.
We're talking about The Marriage of Figaro.
Yes, this is the lovely duet between the Countess and Susanna. And just listening to that alone, without any context, you don't need the story. You just need to listen to that extraordinarily beautiful music. This opera is one series of one beautiful tune after another.
Yeah, and that shows the many levels on which opera can be experienced. You can go there, close your eyes, and listen to the music.
Mm-hmm.
You can go and watch the spectacle of the incredible sets and costumes. I have to say, in the Metropolitan Opera, there was more cleavage than I've seen even on television.
That's true. But in those days, a lot of cleavage was shown, those dresses. I don't know how they managed some of these large ladies, those very high notes, and managed to stay in those very,
with those very,
very
tight, low-cut
costumes.
I know. It's a feat of art.
Of breathing, I suppose. So
let's talk about another character who's in this opera, The Marriage of Figaro. His name is Cherubino. He's an adolescent boy. He's always played by a woman in mm-hmm. the opera. He's, what would you say, 16 years old. He's discovered women. He's discovered sexuality. And he's in love with every single woman in the whole opera.
In the opera, that's right, which really convolutes the plot a little bit. But this is a wonderful character that I think Mozart must have related to very well. It's about adolescent love. It's about that time when you first fall in love. You begin to have those feelings. And not being a boy, but the testosterone is clearly very high in Cherubino. And he's in love with every female in the opera. And he approaches one after the other. He's especially in love with the Countess, who is far above him. He filches a ribbon of hers and he wears it next to his heart. I mean, all the little things we do when we first fall in love. And that whole thing of, you know, I'm in love and it's so wonderful. And I'm in love and it's breaking my heart. I'm miserable because I can't be with the beloved. All of the wonderful things we experience when we first fall in love.
And the funny thing also about this character is each one is so sincere, but he goes from one to the next really without missing a beat.
Exactly, yes. And Figaro at one point calls him an amorous butterfly.
Exactly.
Farfallone amoroso. So the Count and he keep tripping one another up, which is sort of, they're both in Susanna's bedroom. Cherubino is in there. The Count comes in and Cherubino has to hide. Someone else comes in and the Count has to hide. So it's broad slapstick and farce.
The woman who plays the adolescent boy has to be very good, because there's a certain moment where she's a woman playing a man dressed as a woman.
Dressed as a woman, yes. There's a little irony in that, I think, where Mozart dresses her as a woman, even though it's a boy. So Cherubino was described actually by Kierkegaard as, in his book Either Or, he says there are three stages of love, and Cherubino represents the first stage of adolescent love. We're in love. I mean, it's as simple as that. The second stage, then, he said, was Papageno in The Magic Flute, a man who wants a simple life, a simple love, a wife and children. And then the third stage is the dissolute Don Giovanni. And that Cherubino may be a Don Giovanni in the making,
right.
But at this point there's an innocence. The reason for having the role cast as a soprano, which was common at that time and not so common in ours, this is called a pants role, grew out of history, I suppose, that the castrati had been singing these roles. Now there were no longer any castrati. One or two of Mozart's roles did have a castrato in, and we'll talk about that a little more when we come to Radamisto. But
it'd be pretty ironic to have a castrato playing Cherubino.
Yes, it would. Though the first Orpheus and Eurydice, there were two castrati, both men castrati singing
wow.
Orpheus and Eurydice, which is sort of amazing.
Yeah.
So, and also the sound of that light, high voice, it doesn't suggest the voice of the boy hasn't broken yet, but it has a wonderful quality to it that was very popular. So where you want to have this young sound of a young man, an adolescent man, typically it is a soprano who sings the pants role. It happens later again with Der Rosenkavalier, Richard Strauss, when he did a sort of neoclassicism in Der Rosenkavalier. He has The Knight of the Silver Rose is a pants role. So it happens in many operas. So I thought maybe the one we could play today, the aria, is Voi che sapete. This is a little song that Cherubino has written, and he sings it for the Countess in her boudoir in the morning of all this shenanigans in the dressing room. This is before they decide to dress him as a woman, and when they're halfway through getting his boy clothes off and into a skirt, the Count knocks on the door, and there's consternation. They have to hide Cherubino. But at this point, he's singing of his love for the Countess, Voi che sapete, and it's Cecilia Bartoli.
And let's just use this opportunity to point out the double standard of the Count, who on the one hand wants to go philandering, but on the other hand is extremely jealous and furious that this adolescent boy might be talking to his
wife.
Oh,
yes, he raises all hell. There's no way his wife can play around, but exactly. He can.
Okay, so let's hear it.
And that was part of Cherubino's aria from The Marriage of Figaro. I probably should say a little something about ensembles, Marie-Charlotte, in relation to this opera. Up to this time, operas very often were just one singer or two singers and not much else. Mozart manages to blend everyone together. And in the finale, it's a 20-minute finale to the first act. Again, a scene of chaos and confusion. Always Mozart's first acts end in confusion and high excitement. He sends the audience off on this great high. At the end of Don Giovanni, I'll never forget here at the Santa Fe Opera one year, where everybody is running around the stage in consternation, and there's a little percussion in the orchestra suggesting thunder and lightning, and it really happened. It was unbelievable. Out of the heavens, there was thunder and lightning, as if the amazing thing was it was on cue. It was as if Mozart was up there conducting the crashes of thunder. It was stunning. In this case, it's a fun ensemble where there's been an interesting little situation where Marcellina, who is sort of the chaperone of Rosina earlier on, she is going to insist she wants to marry Figaro, which is a little bizarre. But it turns out that Figaro at one point was short of money, so he borrowed money from Marcellina, and the deal was if he didn't pay it back, he'd have to marry her.
Now, meanwhile, she is old enough to be his mother.
His mother, that's right, exactly. And this actually comes directly from an experience that Mozart himself had when he was falling in love with his wife, Constanza. The mother of Constanza, she had four daughters, was a little concerned and wanted to do a prenuptial agreement that if Mozart didn't marry her daughter, he would pay money to the family. As it turned out, Constanza tore up this piece of paper, but apparently this was happening. Anyway, they're in the discussion middle of this, and the Count is delighted because he thinks, well, if Figaro has to marry Marcellina, he can't marry Susanna, which suited him because then he could tell Susanna, I will give you the dowry enabling Figaro to pay off his debt if you will make love with me.
So it's sexual blackmail.
But as it turns out, Figaro says, no, that can't happen. He said, I'm of noble birth. And they said, you're of noble birth. He said, yes, I have a birthmark to prove it. And he shows the birthmark, and Marcellina goes, oh, Raffaello, you are my son.
So it turns out that not only is she old enough to be his mother,
she is his mother. Right. And Dr. Bartolo, who has been another comic role in this opera, turns out to be the father. So ultimately, these two get married in
the opera. So basically, teen pregnancy and all this stuff is not anything new.
No. And she sings a wonderful aria near the end, Marcellina. She stops being a silly old woman. And she says, you know, we are at the mercy of these men, and we get pregnant and they abandon us. It was exactly a teenage pregnancy. And then she had to give away the baby, who was Figaro, who now shows up later on. It's not new. And this is the point I think that Mozart is making here. So
you were talking about ensembles. The piece we're about to play is a wonderful example of that.
Yes, it is. This is where the truth comes out, and you'll hear the Count saying, they're all talking at once, and the Count says throughout, silencio, silencio, quiet, I want to hear these different people talk. Susanna comes in, and she finds Figaro, her fiancé, in the arms of Marcellina, and has a fit, what's going on? And then she hears that Marcellina is the mother, not the fiancé. It's a really fun piece. So let's just play, it's a short section from this wonderful 20-minute finale of the first act of The Marriage of Figaro.
Sono tre scuole di tre pazzi. Cosa mai vengono a far? Cosa mai vengono a far? Gli alcani senza schiamazzi. Digogli un quel che gli par. Digogli un quel che gli par. Silenzio, silenzio, io son qui per giudicar.
Io dalle scelto avvocato, vengo a far le sue difese, le legittime pretese che vengo a palesare.
E mi parte!
Silenzio, 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 io son qui per giudicar.
Io commuovo al mondo condito, vengo qui per testimoni del promesso
Sono tre matti!
Ora silenzio lo vedremo, il contratto leggeremo, tutto in ordine per andare.
Thank you.
And that's part of the ensemble from the end of the first act of The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. The recording we're listening to today is a DGG recording with James Levine conducting the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra with Ferruccio Forlanetto, Kirite Kanawa, Dawn Upshaw. It's a fabulous cast. In my book, this is one of the best recordings. So you can get that and listen to the opera before you go. There's also videos and DVDs out there, of course, as well.
One of the themes that we have been talking around but not actually getting to is the fact that this was such a transitional time in the history of Europe, and it was a time when notions of what marriage even was or should be were really changing.
Yes, I think so. And I think with the relationship of the count and the countess, that's the old way, the way of the ancien régime, that he would marry his countess, he would set her up, and she would become a woman on a pedestal. And she would bear his children, and he could do exactly as he liked.
And meanwhile, she had to have money and position, and that was why the marriage happened in the first place.
Yes, these could be arranged marriages. In this case, it's not, because they were in love in the Bar of Seville. But she ends up in that terrible situation where she's virtually abandoned and isolated and not really in a position to complain about it. Also, there was a division between the servant and the countess. So traditionally, she would not have been able to turn to Susanna and talk, ask her for help or you know, collude with her, as happens here. Now, with Figaro and Susanna, this is moving towards the new type of relationship, that a man and a woman would come together in equality. I think it's equality that was looked for as much as anything else at the Enlightenment, that this situation would change, that people would marry for love. There was a wonderful quote. It's in my book. I probably can't put my hand on it, but it says that if a man agrees to love his wife, she agrees to obey him, but only on condition that he love her. Very interesting. This came from the 17th century. And this was all part of the transition that was beginning. These are the very beginnings of change in Europe in the Age of Enlightenment. In Austria, it wasn't so bad. But in France, a few years later, the whole thing culminated, blew up in the French Revolution.
And it's so interesting that the ideas of equality in between men and women are paralleling revolutionary ideas about equalizing the great disparities in social class.
Exactly, and that happened over time. The ideas of the Enlightenment of Rousseau. I mean, this time you could go to prison if you read Rousseau. So it was just beginning, and it happened differently in different parts of Europe. Thank goodness we all got over that.
So let's end with the theme of forgiveness. So Everybody's running around the opera for hours, mistrusting each other and eavesdropping on each other and hatching nefarious plots to either try to get out of something or try to get somebody else implicated or whatever. And at the end, everybody's forgiving each other.
Yes, and this is pure Mozart. Mozart was never critical. He never criticizes, and all of his characters, even the bad ones, in quotes, have their redeeming features, I suppose. In this, at the very end, in the garden, all different people are different, having different assignations with one another. It's all very confusing. There's a lot of running around. And finally, the Count realizes something's going on, and he comes out angry. And Figaro asks for forgiveness, and he says, no, I'm not going to forgive anyone. And he believes he's been in the garden house with Susanna, and the door opens, and who comes out but his wife? And this is the moment at which the Count turns to his wife, whom he does love, and he says, Contessa, perdono. Forgive me, forgive me. And she is the one who turns to him, not forgiving only the Count, but everybody in the opera. And in a way, by projection, us in the audience. There's a wonderful sense of forgiveness. It's all right to forgive. And things may go crazy tomorrow. This is the end of one crazy day. But for today, let's kiss and make up and forgive. To me, this is one of the most beautiful sections of music in the entire operatic repertoire. You'll hear the Count, first of all, singing, no, he won't forgive anyone else. And then when he turns to her and says, Contessa, perdono. Let's listen to that from very near the end of The Marriage of Figaro.
Perdono, perdono. No, perdono, perdono. No, perdono, perdono. No, il petto di mio
I hate to have to come out of that. It's wonderful. It's very beautiful music. Maybe I should say a quick word about the production at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. We are going to have an absolutely wonderful Figaro in Luca Pisarone, who is well known in Italy, a baritone, who will be coming to Santa Fe for the first time to sing this role. There are three of our wonderful apprentices, young women who were presented to the opera world here in Santa Fe, who are now making international names for themselves all over the place. The Count is Mariusz Kwiecin, a Polish tenor who will be wonderful. Isabel Leonard sings the role of Cherubino, and this production will be by Jonathan Kent, who has been here a couple of times, does a wonderful production with the conductor Kenneth Montgomery. So I think this is going to be an exciting production from the Santa Fe Opera.
And opera tickets can be procured at santafeopera.org or by calling in Santa Fe in New Mexico, 505-986-5900 or 800-280-4654. Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled, which is the book that accompanies the Santa Fe Opera every year, and it can be had at not only the opera but many local bookstores.
That's right.
Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.